Welcome to the Jonathan Mayberry Patient Zero panel. I will be moderating. My name is Widget Walls from needcoffee.com. And, of course, here is Jonathan Mayberry.
Yes.
And so I think we're gonna talk a little bit about the book and the books. And then I think if we're lucky, Jonathan might grace us with a bit from the upcoming book, the sequel to Patient Zero.
Yes.
And then we'll take some questions. Jonathan, I guess the first question, because I've read the book, and I think the about page 90, I realized that my productivity for the weekend was shot, and I was going to have to just kind of work through and finish it. So thank you for that. Mitch, thank you. I guess the first question, after reading like Zombie CSU and stuff, is if you look at World War Z is kind of the, shall we say, the Red Storm Rising of zombie books. What compelled you to write the Rainbow Six of zombie books?
It's funny, I started working on Zombie CSU before I read World War Z. I've been a zombie nut for a long, long, long time, so I've always wanted to write a zombie novel. I want to give a little bit of backstory to how I got into the whole zombie thing. When I was a kid, my grandmother was always telling me about what she called the larger world, supernatural things. And I was fascinated by it from the time I could walk, or maybe even younger. The local movie theater started showing two movies every Saturday afternoon, two horror movies every Saturday afternoon, I was there. Now, we're talking, I was like 8, 9, 10 years old, sneaking into the movies or paying, for those of you who are my age, you understand, 35 cents got me into the movie back in 1968. For those who are younger than that, you're going to go, really? But yeah, 35 cents got me in for two movies, five cartoons, and a whole bunch of trailers, and I was set. And it was one of those gigantic, big Art Deco movie houses in Philadelphia that could have, originally it was supposed to seat 2,400 people. And everything was roped off except for one little section. So naturally, I snuck into the balcony, which had been closed since, you know, I think Washington was president. So I'm up there alone when Night of the Living Dead, you know, first showed in Philadelphia, October 2nd, 1968. And now, I was a really smart-ass kid. You know, I was doing martial arts since I was in diapers just about. So I'd already figured out how to fight vampires, and I figured out how to fight werewolves, and the mummy was never a problem. A slow shuffling guy in very dry bandages. I mean, we played with matches as a hobby. And for Godzilla, you know, he stops Philadelphia. Everyone's running this way. He's running this way. I go that way. You know, that the right angle fleeing thing always made sense to me. But then George Romero threw zombies at us, and ghouls at the time. And it was something that completely broke the mold. You had these creatures. First off, they were everywhere. Anyone could turn into one with just the slightest little help from a little bite. And if, even if in the original film, even if somebody died, you know, just fell down and died from a heart attack, there arises a zombie. Everybody turned into a zombie. As a rule changer, you can't get much more dramatic. And I'm sitting there in the movie theater going, oh, crap. Because, you know, I saw Ben. I love Ben, you know, the hero of Night of the Living Dead. And he's beating up these zombies, and everybody's running through them. And I'm thinking, you know, one-on-one, you know, I'm only 10, but I'm fast, you know, especially when I'm scared, because I'm really fast when I'm scared. But then there was more and more and more. You never knew if fleeing meant running toward, you know. So by the time I got out of there, I knew I wanted to do something with zombies, and I loved zombies my whole life. I didn't get a chance to write anything about zombies until my editor at Citadel Press called me up and said, can you give me a zombie book? Because I was already doing folklore books, supernatural folklore books for Citadel. And I said, sure, what kind? She said, I don't know, hit me with some ideas, and I hit her with the idea of Zombie CSU. Because I'd spent all these years talking, you know, thinking about how the real world would react. I liked the practical approach. And I also didn't like the fact that we lost so quickly in all the movies, you know, everything crumbled. So I researched Zombie CSU, and I was talking to SWAT team guys and Homeland Security and cops and doctors and forensics experts, and I'm gathering all this information about how the real world would deal with zombies. And I'm thinking, man, this would make a hell of a novel. This would make a hell of a novel. Why am I not writing the novel? I'm going to write the novel. And I took the stuff from there. I sat down at a diner and did one something I'd never done before. I started writing by hand. I didn't know I was actually capable of doing that. I'm a computer geek, so I actually found that, hey, the hand works, you know, and I'm writing, and I'm loving this story, and I'm like, I'm writing a zombie novel. I'm writing a techno-thriller zombie novel. Yeah, there's a market for that. Because you know all the other techno-thriller zombie novels that are out there. And I pitched it to my agent, and she loved it. And she started shopping it around, and bam, we sold it. So I got into writing zombie novels kind of because it was my destiny. I was you know, scarred from life at age 10, and the only way to address that damage is to write a zombie novel, and there we go.
So writing was basically cheaper than therapy, I take it.
Oh, yeah. Ask any writer. Every book you write is good for about 4 months, 6 months of therapy. And, or if you're a slow writer, it's good for a year.
So, and I think you'd said previously when you were working on CSU that when talking to a lot of these authorities and the SWAT teams and whatever else, that a lot of them had run zombie simulations.
Yeah.
Just for the hell of it, you know.
Yeah, that really cracked me up. I talked to some guys at Homeland and some guys in SWAT, a couple different areas of SWAT, and I asked them, I said, well, you know, I want to get your opinion on how you guys might deal with it. Let me tell you about this, about what zombies are. And they're like, tell me about zombies. And you're talking about fast zombies, slow zombies. You're talking about rage zombies. You're talking about risen dead. You're talking about, and they're firing this back at me, and they're saying, well, you know, of course we do this, this, and this, and then they're deconstructing the movies. As much as they all have seen these films. It's funny, almost everyone who has a profession of and who sees a film in which their profession could possibly, you know, overlap, they actually do the thought. So when you ask them the questions, they've already thought about it. And the SWAT guys were a riot because they ran fast and slow zombie scenarios. They ran zombies coming down the street, you know, and barricade, you know, how to hold the line. They ran scenarios for retaking the streets from zombies. And if you really want to get them started, talk about 28 weeks later. Because, you can actually see veins just pulse in their head. Because whoever, if they had a military advisor for that film, he was on crack. Everything was wrong. I mean, first off, you have zombies. You have zombie-ish. You have a guy in a helicopter.
Yeah.
It's an army helicopter. And he uses the blades.
Yeah.
The thing that would probably destroy the helicopter. They got these things they invented a long time ago called miniguns. You'd park there 10 feet above the zombies. Zombies aren't going to do high jumps on the ground. The miniguns will tear them apart. You can outrun parts. We also have Abrams tanks. These things, I mean, they had to rebuild all the roads in Germany after World War II to accommodate the size of the tanks we were building. These things could just drive up and down the streets. You know, you have zombie pate everywhere. It no longer becomes an army problem, it becomes a sanitation department problem. So these guys had already thought about this, and when I'm asking them questions, I didn't have to feed them any information. They're giving me stuff. They're talking about, you know, they also love deconstructing the ease with which heroes in zombie movies get headshots with handguns.
That's hard.
Yeah. The guy, and my favorite zombie film is Dawn of the Dead, the remake of Dawn of the Dead. I think it's the best zombie film ever made, the director's cut. Don't throw things at me if you disagree, but we can take it outside later on. But as much as I love the character that Jake Weber plays, you know, he sells TVs at Best Buy, and suddenly he's popping zombies at 20 yards and 30 yards, shush, with a handgun. And I'm thinking, yeah, go on the range and do that while you're calm and see if you can do anything. Then try it really when you're nervous. Not so much. But the Homeland guys, they had run scenarios on fast and slow zombies, too. They'd also run Godzilla scenarios. They'd run alien invasion scenarios. Now, and tax dollars at work. The reason they do this, they have these groups that come from all over the world. They're counter-terrorist groups from all over the world. And they do these weekend or week-long retreats where they run every possible scenario. The idea is so that no matter what happens, they have something, you know, prepared. It's a shame FEMA doesn't do this. But so they had, you know, and sometimes they have to entertain themselves because there's only so many times you can run the scenario of hostage situation, guy would, you know, strap on bomb. So they actually ran the zombie stuff. So when I was asking them, they had answers prepared. It was an incredibly surreal experience to have a guy from Homeland or a guy from who's a top SWAT trainer say, oh yeah, you know, the way we would cap the zombie is this. And that, you know, one group's calling them Zeds, Zoms, UAs. I love UAs, undead Americans. the SWAT guy from Dallas called them UAs. They were already prepared for me. I loved it.
I know some people at the CDC, and I understand that they've thought about it there as well,
oh, yeah,
about fast and slow zombies. So you're talking to all of these SWAT guys. Was there a particular, and getting into Patient Zero, let me just say, show of hands, how many people have read Patient Zero with our friend Joe Ledger? Okay. Did you want to, for those who have not, would you want to give like a quick 50 words or less setup?
Patient Zero deals with introduces Joe Ledger, a Baltimore cop who's recruited by a secret government organization called the Department of Military Sciences, the DMS, to help stop a group of terrorists who have a plague that will turn people into zombies. It's as close to real science as you can get, because I did a lot of research on which diseases could possibly be constructed or modified. Joe Ledger's character is kind of a hero waiting to happen. You know, he's airborne ranger, he's got a martial arts background, he's a completely fractured person, but that gives him a certain degree of edge. So he's the right guy for the job, but he's never had an opportunity to be a hero before, and this just kind of falls in his lap, and he winds up being the right guy for this job. And he's an amalgam of a couple people that, you know, a couple real-world people, and he's a fun character. Patient Zero is the first of at least three novels. I'm writing the third one now.
So that was going to be my next question about the origin of Joe Ledger. So were all of those people that you had met during the course of putting together CSU, or?
Well, actually, there's a little bit of me and Joe. Some of his childhood stuff is the same as mine. We both do the same martial art. I've been practicing jiu-jitsu for well over 40 years. I'm a former bodyguard, and I used to train SWAT teams and law enforcement personnel in arrest and control techniques, in, you know, overcoming somebody bigger, stronger, faster, and taking control. So I have that. I draw on that for myself. But there are a number of people I've met over the years, several who were in the martial arts schools where I was either a student or teacher, and quite a few guys from the law enforcement programs that I did. That I tapped, and these guys are, you know, borderline superheroes. They're incredibly fast, incredibly strong, and the one thing about SWAT guys, which a lot of people don't know, is that they have the lowest rate of suicide of anyone in the police department. They usually have established families. They're good family men, and when they arrive on the scene, the likelihood of someone dying has diminished significantly. They're not the kill them all, let God sort them out mentality they're portrayed in the films, and I liked the idea of someone who was that calm, cool, and controlled being the central character. And one of the funny things is some of the reviews, almost all the reviews for the book have been good. Every once in a while, someone will say Joe is not a realistic character because he's too efficient. No one who knows anything about SWAT or special forces would make that same statement, because these guys are in those groups because they are the very best of the best. You don't have a guy in Delta Force who's known for hesitating. You just don't, because he died during training. You don't have a guy in SWAT who is going to, you know, be emotional. He's going to rationally think his way through the situation and react according to training. And so Joe is based on established procedure and personality types of people I've met in those fields, military and law enforcement.
Well, the other character I wanted to ask you about was one of my other favorites, which you can probably guess would be, you know, he goes by many names, the deacon, the pope, church. Where does he come from, our fearless leader, Joe's boss, new boss?
I'm not going to be telling you whole much about that. Mr. Church is a very mysterious character, and he will remain mysterious in different ways throughout the book. You do learn a lot about what he was doing in the 70s in Dragon Factory, the second book, because we find out that he was part of a group called The List, a group of ultra top special ops agents that were from different countries that were working on a particular problem. And but you still don't know where he came from, what his real name is, and Some people actually are making bets that he'll turn out to be a villain. And I'm not saying anything either way. He is my favorite character to write, however, because I know more about him than I'm writing about, but I still don't know everything about him. I'm letting myself be surprised. Sometimes when he opens his mouth, he'll say something or do something, and I go, wow, that's interesting. But there are a lot of devious things about him. The cookie thing, for example.
Yes.
For those who haven't read the book, during the interview between Mr. Church, who's the head of the DMS, and Joe Ledger, Joe picked up in Ocean City, Maryland, brought to this undisclosed location, sits him down to interrogate him. We don't know at first that he's actually interviewing him for the job, but it's very weird. And he puts out a plate of cookies, vanilla wafers and Oreos. And the selection of which cookie Joe takes, how he eats it, when he takes it, everything that's in that has a psychological connection to the way in which people who screen spies would work. There is nothing in there that's pure chance. Everything there is based on psychological screening. Joe is only partly aware of that. And it's one of Church's tricks. But there's also other things about the cookies later on. Everything about the cookies actually has a meaning. To the point where now, when I do book signings, I usually have a stack of Oreos at my signings.
Do you take a look at who takes them and when and how they eat them?
Actually, I do. I'm trying to apply Church's logic because, you know, I still distrust anyone who would take a vanilla wafer over an Oreo. As Joe says, he thinks that's a sign of pure evil.
So, staying on Church for a second, I know you'd said that there's obviously some of you in all of the characters. But how much of you is in Mr. Church, you think?
Maybe part of his moral compass, but he's really more based on my high school disciplinarian across
it all comes
whose
out
desk
now.
I spent many, many hours, who had a similar tactic. The various times I was in the disciplinarian office, he'd sit me down there and I'd sit here, and he would just stare at me for an hour. He would be doing this with his fingers the whole time. If I looked down at his fingers, he would lean forward and do it more. And that was it. That was the tension for an hour. And he only took one student at a time. The guy, if he wasn't an ex-CIA spook who happened to wind up in detention as as the person running it, I would be very surprised. I think the guy has a weird background that I didn't know about. But it's a combination of him and my initial jiu-jitsu instructor when I first started studying, and a guy I know who was a former CIA assassin in Vietnam, Ronald Duncan.
So for all we know, in high school, you could have been screened for some kind of job by this ex-spook.
Yeah, I think he was trying to decide whether I was going to prison or not.
So I know we have... You have Dragon Factory in the Flesh here, which is the sequel. What can you tell us about Joe Ledger's next adventure?
Well, actually, I'm going to read you the back cover text.
Oh, please.
Because my editor actually wrote the back cover text. Usually I don't like when an editor does this. I like what they wrote. Joe Ledger and the DMS, Department of Military Sciences, face their deadliest threat yet when they go up against two competing groups of geneticists bent on world domination. One side is creating exotic transgenic monsters and genetically enhanced mercenary armies. The other is using 21st century technology to continue the Nazi master race program begun by Joseph Mengele. Both sides want to see the DMS destroyed, and they've drawn first blood. Neither side is prepared for Joe Ledger as he leads Echo Team to war under a black flag. I had a lot of fun writing this book. This comes out in March, by the way, March 3rd. There's going to be a fairly big campaign behind it, which is nice. And it does not include zombies, by the way. I know I'm a zombie guy, too, but the Joe Ledger series is not a zombie series. It's science gone wrong, and guns are being used to control that. it's kind of like if Michael Crichton knew how to write action. You know, One of the pitches, I mean, by the way, and it was just optioned, the series was just optioned by Sony TV. So we're hoping it's actually going to wind up being a television show. But if you imagine, for those who haven't read it, it's Fringe meets 24. that would be a great way to kind of get your mind around what the series is. And I actually want to read you the opening of the book. It's a very short prologue, and it'll give you a sense of where the story is going. And by the way, if you haven't read Patient Zero, it won't spoil anything. When you get this does come out, do not read the last couple of chapters first. It will spoil the book for you. Guaranteed. And if anyone tries to tell you what happened to the last chapter, kill them. Okay, prologue. 1 week ago, Otto Wirths was the second worst mass murderer in the history of the world. Compared to him, Hitler, Stalin, Attila the Hun, and even Alexander the Great were amateurs, posers who could not hold a candle to Otto and his body count. Only one person was worse, Cyrus Jacoby. That wasn't his real name, and in a way he had no real name. Like Otto, Cyrus was a freak. Like Otto, Cyrus was a monster. A week ago, I'd never heard of either of them. Almost no one had. A week ago, they were on no watch list. They were not sought by any world governments. Their names were not muttered in hateful curses or angry prayers by a single person on planet Earth. Yet together, they had done more harm than anyone. Together, they had very quietly slaughtered tens of millions. Tens of millions. At night, when they sat down to their dinner, they did not dwell on past accomplishments. A champion athlete doesn't dwell on the preliminaries. 1 week ago, 7 days before I had even heard of them, Otto Wirths placed a large digital clock on the wall above the elaborate workstation where he and Cyrus spent much of their waking hours. The clock was set to tick off seconds and minutes. Otto adjusted the time to read 10,080. 10,080 minutes. 168 hours, 7 days, 1 week. After he pressed the start button, Otto and Cyrus clinked glasses of Perrier Jouet, which at over $6,000 a bottle was the world's most expensive champagne. They sipped the bubbles and smiled and watched as the first 60 seconds ran away, and then the next 60. The extinction clock had begun. Then we jump forward to now. I crouched in the dark. I was bleeding, and something inside was broken. Maybe something inside my head, too. The door was barred. I had 3 bullets left. 3 bullets and a knife. The pounding on the door was like thunder. I knew the door wouldn't hold. They would get in. Somewhere, the extinction clock was ticking down. If I was still in the room when it hit zero, more people would die than perish during the Black Death and all of the pandemics put together. I thought I could stop them. I had tried to stop them. I had to. It was down to me or no one. It wasn't my fault I came into it so late. They chased us and messed with our heads and ran us around, and by the time we knew what we were up against, the clock had nearly run its course. We tried. Over the last week, I left a trail of bodies behind me from Denver to Costa Rica to the Bahamas. Some of those bodies were human. Some, well, I don't know what the hell you would call them. The pounding was louder. The door was buckling. The crossbar bended. It was only seconds before the lock or the hinges gave out, and then they'd come howling in here. Then it would be them against me. I was hurt. I was bleeding. I had 3 bullets and a knife. I got to my feet and faced the door, my gun in my left hand, my knife in my right. I smiled. Let them come. And that's how the book opens. And by the way, just for those who have not yet read the book, either book, if you go to my Facebook page or my website, which is jonathanmayberry.com, and there's flyers here that have the link, there's a free prequel short story called Countdown available on the website. There will be a free interim story that takes place between Patient Zero and Dragon Factory. There's going to be a free interim story that is actually kind of a sequel to Patient Zero, and that'll be up around Thanksgiving. And then Dragon Factory comes out in March. The books are also available as e-downloads for those who have Kindles and other e-book readers.
And in addition to Jonathan's flyer about himself, he does have one on Dragon Factory as well, so you can come get information about that up here. One last question, and I'll throw it out to the audience, just because writing techno-thrillers with these mad scientists who need these guns in order to keep them under control, what is your take on, because obviously you've got good people using science, bad people using science, what is your take in general on I guess, these scientists and their penchant to, a lot of them, to let's say, press buttons without asking, should I be pressing this button?
Well, you know, it's funny. There are a couple of takes on science and the morality and ethics of how it's used. Michael Crichton's take was that we spend so much time thinking about whether we could, we don't think about whether we should. And that's one view. My view is I don't think that the motives are clear or clean for most people who are handling the cutting-edge technology. I am enough of an idealist to want and to believe that it's possible for us to be able to manage these technologies. I am, however, enough of a realist to believe that greed is a greater motivating factor than compassion for many people. And unfortunately, since a lot of the people who should never be in power are in power because they've fought to get in power, whether it's business or government, they're often the ones who shouldn't have this technology. You know, we have 19-year-olds and 18-year-olds running the unmanned predator aircraft that are being used in Afghanistan and Iraq. Yeah, maybe they're really great with video games, but you know, are they mature enough to make decisions? Are they mature enough to handle the material? We have companies that are trying to patent cell lines. It's become a big thing in the press. Crichton did a book called Next about this, where they can actually patent your cell lines and own your tissue, own your cells. You don't own them. They're trying to patent parts of the human genome and animal genomes for all sorts of creation. They'll get grants of some of these companies because they say, yes, it may help this particular type of disease. And it may. And, of course, they'll profit from that. But I don't really believe that there is as much altruism as there should be. And I do believe there's a lot of greed out there running some of these giant corporations. So science, I think, is often in the hands of the wrong people. And we need stronger watchdogs. And granted, the DMS, as created, is not intended to be a watchdog organization. They're created by, that group was created by someone who no longer has faith that governments and corporations will manage their own technologies in the best interests of the people. So they're there when it goes off the rails. And it's not really, because even though it's a techno thriller and there's combat in it, there's a tendency for people to think, well, that you know, it's a Tom Clancy or Patrick Robinson right-wing sort of thing. Actually, I'm fairly left-wing. I just am the kind of left-wing guy who will pull a trigger in defense of the innocent or ideals, and that's the character that Joe is. He doesn't want to start a fight. He really doesn't. But if somebody starts a fight and it's going to overwhelm the general population, then somebody's got to make a stand, and he's the guy. So, but no, I don't trust that science will be used and is being used in the best interests of the people. Sadly.
Okay. Well, we'll throw it open to you guys for whatever questions. Just show of hands, and if you please, Mr. Mayberry, we have prizes that we can throw at your heads. So, right here.
I have a two-part question. The first one is that I've wanted Zombie CSU since I saw it last year, but I can't find it anywhere downstairs or upstairs inside the shop.
Okay, Larry Smith, bookseller in the dealer's room, has had five copies of Zombie CSU yesterday. And every bookstore should carry it, and for some bizarre reason, it's in the metaphysical section. Yes, and this actually makes me bleed from the pores. This is the third book I did. Zombie CSU is the third book I did for Citadel Press. The first two, Vampire Universe and the Cryptopedia, were in fact metaphysical, you know, cult, paranormal, and so on. They consider this a book in that series. It's not. It's pop culture. You know, there's George Romero zombies. So every bookstore had it, but it was in metaphysical, and nobody saw it there. Luckily, people ordered it online, and you can get it from any bookstore. Any independent bookstore, any bookstore can order it because it's still available. It's actually now in second printing. Larry Smith had some copies yesterday. He also has copies of Patient Zero and They Bite, which is my new, the fourth in that series, or third if you discount Zombie CSU as metaphysical, which deals with supernatural predators and folklore and fiction, and has interviews with John Carpenter and Mike Mignola and just tons of pop culture folks, Jack Ketchum, Peter Straub, a lot of fun.
So that was your first part of the question.
The second part is that I take public transportation every day, long, 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 and I've gotten into the habit of listening to audiobooks. Is there any chance that these will turn into audiobooks?
Not at the moment, but anything's possible. With Patient Zero, since it was a zombie techno thriller, they didn't really think that was going to hit the mainstream, and your audiobooks are usually mainstream. Hmm. Audiobooks are almost always done for hardbacks, and these are trade paperback originals. We'll see what happens when the third book, King of Plagues, comes out. Now, there is a possibility that my first young adult novel, which is really written for adults, we're just calling it young adults because those publishers pay better, Rotten Ruin, which comes out next fall, may be an audio. Rotten Ruin. It's the first of at least two zombie novels set 14 years after the events, very similar to Night of the Living Dead, where something caused the dead to rise, and anybody who dies kind of rises as a zombie. And it's a 15-year-old kid who has to get a job, so he's apprenticing to his zombie hunter brother. Mm-hmm. And it'll be out in hardback from Simon & Schuster in the fall, to be followed by Dust and Decay the following year. And that may be an audiobook. We'll see how that goes. That's really up to the publisher, though.
Yeah, in the back.
Sorry. Like everyone else at Dragon Con, I think I can write a book. Now, your writing and the genre that you were always a fan of, how do you draw the line, or what safeguards do you use to ensure that your original idea isn't actually something that you got from somebody else 30 years ago and just don't remember it?
Yeah, you can't copyright an idea. So I can write... anyone who's written a zombie novel ever since Night of the Living Dead is copying off George Romero. And George Romero copped off I Am Legend, the vampire novel by Richard Matheson. So you can't copyright an idea. You can only you should only concern yourself about the specific way in which you write it. So if I were to write a novel about a group of colonial marines going out in space to fight aliens, it may be, people say, well, yeah, that's kind of like Aliens. In that one Colonial Marines, Aliens, one-sentence description. But the way in which I would write the book would be different. And an existing genre is always looking for more books to satisfy that audience. Because once somebody has read Brian Caine's books and David Wellington's and Max Brooks's and mine, if they're really into zombies, they're going to want the next zombie book. And we're putting out novels a year apart, for the most part. And Max Brooks has only written two books in 5 years. So the audience has to be fed. So you can always write something new in that same genre. You could actually write a book about a kid going to school for wizardry. And I just wouldn't call him like Larry Nodder. That might get you in trouble. But if you're a writer and you have a good idea for a book in an existing genre, that's the higher chance of selling than if you're a writer and you have an idea for a book that fits in no known genre, because you can't sell that at all. And I also believe that everyone who thinks they should write a book should write a book. Because almost everyone has at least one good book in them.
Yeah, right here.
You, in your current novel, you're dealing with manufactured viruses. And we all know that as viruses evolve and literally become more complex, there's a greater risk of having something like this happen. Do you think there's a greater chance of it being a constructed, manufactured virus versus a natural mutation, such as an offspring of Ebola or something like that, that could cause this?
It's a real good question, and natural mutation takes time. So I think eventually Mother Nature will get cranky enough to kick up almost anything. Whether it's going to, whether that would happen in our lifetime, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, Ebola continues to evolve. But Ebola is a weird virus anyway. Nobody knows where it came from exactly. Nobody knows why it stopped spreading, because it did, and it shouldn't have. Nobody knows why it every time it shows up again, it's a different strain. I actually think, and truly think, that somebody's screwing around with it. I think somebody's test driving it. And it was because of that, my only conspiracy theory that I actually own, that gave me the idea for Patient Zero, because they are test driving a pathogen in that. And Ebola shows up as a theme in King of Plagues, my third Joe Ledger book. But I really do think people are messing with combinations of it. I know bioweapons research continues to go on. And one of the things that it kind of fits into Michael Crichton's idea of whether we should try something is that people will will research all the variations they can think of on a virus in just in case something happens. Well, that sounds great, but things get out. We know that. We know that, you know, HIV, Ebola, things get out of the lab, no matter how many precautions we take. If you start creating this stuff, you could wind up destroying what you're trying to save, and I think that's a lot more likely than Mother Nature kicking something up, though she has been known to throw us some curves.
I was thinking more about the fact that we can easily identify the shepherd's crook. I mean, just about any doctor in the world's going to glance at it. But they're starting to do more and more RNA stuff that's below the virus that is restructuring the genes.
Yeah.
That seems to me that Mother Nature isn't going to randomly kick that up, but we know it's going on right now.
Yeah, well, that's Dragon Factory. Dragon Factory deals a lot with genetic manipulation. In fact, one of the subplots deals with some very bad people who take genetic diseases like Tay-Sachs and sickle cell and turn them into communicable viruses. And that research is actually going on because the theory or the statement is that we need to do that research in case natural mutation happens. It would take 1,000 generations or more for natural mutation for that to happen. But it is interesting that people are still working on that sort of thing. I do think it's going to come out of a lab. Whatever is going to, if there's going to be something that's going to be a major unstoppable pandemic, it's going to come out of the lab. And that's why I write plague type novels, because that scares me. It scares me more than werewolves, vampires, ghosts, or anything. Guys with their junior wisdom, man, that's a one really creepy story. I was researching an idea for a story in which scientists would take DNA from cockroaches and give it to humans, because they would be able to live in almost any polluted environment and be sustained. They could, you know, eat through almost any substance and be nourished and also escape, and et cetera, et cetera. And a friend who was doing, this is back in 1990, there was a woman I knew who was working in genetics, and I asked her about this. She said, let me look it up. And she found that, you know, 200 government-funded studies on that, ongoing. That creeped me the hell out. Because that sounds reasonable. If you, the logic there, if you can't fix the planet, change the species. They think that's good thinking. You know, holy crap.
Well, and people have been playing around with that for a long time. I know that the Japanese were screwing around with the Black Death for World War II. Tested it in bits of China, and to this day they still have outbreaks of it, and they know that that's the strain that the Japanese did, because they know the nature of it. So not only can you test drive it, but it'll test drive itself.
Oh, yeah,
a while.
Yeah, yeah, sure will.
They're still playing around with smallpox.
Oh, yeah,
as a
sure.
Biological weapons. So yeah, none of that's changed.
Tuberculosis has made a comeback, and smallpox is making a comeback. I mean, and also our ability to be immune or resistant to it has diminished because of the incorrect use of antibiotics. And
that's something that drives me up the wall. Oh, go get antibiotics for it. It's a virus. It isn't going to help.
No,
you're
not.
Either vaccinated or you're at risk, period.
True.
Sure.
Right here.
First of all, I want to thank you for writing what I tend to think of as a thinking zombie novel, where I get so frustrated as people, I had to throw the book against the wall 3 times before I picked it up again. that was a real relief for me. And also, I think you hit the nail on the head with the whole looking at what people do for money and power and all that. I'm definitely looking forward to the next books, but I'm wondering, will we find out any more about the characters in his team? Because I just think that some of those members, there's a lot more beneath the surface that we're getting.
Yeah, well, not all the team makes it to the end of Patient Zero, as you know. Top and Bunny are the ones who are going to be throughout the series. But no, the thing about the DMS, no one in the DMS is safe. No character is safe. Not everybody will get out of Dragon Factory alive, for example. I it's kind of the way the English, if you ever watch British TV, they'll kill off a character, they'll kill off Primeval, they killed off the hero, Blake Seven, you know. They love killing off the main characters because it keeps you
you're unable to rest and think, oh, well, these are the series characters, there's no real tension. Yeah, there's tension. But as far as learning more about them, in the second book, Dragon Factory, we don't really explore Top and Bunny that much more. We do explore Grace, we do explore Church quite deeply, and there's a new character named Bug who's the computer guy. We get some more with Doctor Who, and for those who haven't read the book, Doc H.U., and he is the science geek for the DMS. In book three, in Dragon Factory, there's a lot more. But book three about the King of Plagues, there's a lot more of Top and Bunny. And a couple of other characters that are introduced. Echo Team goes through some changes. We get some new people. But Top and Bunny get kind of a solo adventure in the middle of King of Plagues, and we learn a lot about them. And I'm basing that, actually it's a fairly relatively new subplot, I'm basing that on something that's happening right now with the young fellows who were accidentally crossed the border into Iran and were kidnapped. Turns out that one of them is the son of the next door neighbor of our best friends, my wife and my best friends. And Top and Bunny are trying to get them out because there's an agenda that the public doesn't know about. So we will get to know a lot more about them. And I may or may not give you more on Mr. Church. I'm trying. A lot of it depends on whether they St. Martin's wants more books. Because if this is the last book, I might throw more in. But I think there's going to be at least two or three more after this. So I might string the Mr. Church story out just a little more. And Rudy, we'll definitely get more about Rudy. Yeah, Rudy's a favorite character of mine. He has a decent role in Dragon Factory, but a big role in King of Plagues. Dragon Factory is kind of a different book because it's a race, it's a chase. So Joe is separated from everyone for a good part of the book. And by the time they get back together, there isn't time for new things about the characters so much as it is trying to save the world, because they are really trying to save the world in this book. That Extinction Clock thing is not an exaggeration for what the bad guys are doing.
So let me ask you this, going to the idea of the variable number of books in the Joe Ledger series. Do you already have in your head, when it comes time to end it, I have this little nugget here that I'm going to close it out with, or is that still an open?
No, I got a James Bond sort of thing with that. He's going to live forever. But that really depends, because I could get into a perverse mood and kill him off at some point, too. I mean, anything's possible.
Of course.
But I do have about 20 other Joe Ledger novels planned. If St. Martin's doesn't continue the series, we will sell it elsewhere. Mm. But I'm pretty sure St. Martin's, they're doing really well with the books. I'm pretty sure St. Martin's is going to come back to it. It hasn't reached the part of the cycle where they would naturally say, all right, what are your next three books? Because only one book's out yet. But I'm pretty sure they're going to ask for more, and I know which ones I'm going to pitch to them. Mm. And the cockroach DNA thing will factor into one of those stories, because that's just the creepiest thing I ever heard.
Yeah, right here.
I have to say, I really respect the amount of research and journalism you throw into a lot of your writing, but I guess the first part of the question is, how much of any creative tangents or theories that you want to incorporate of your own into your books?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the last question? Inspector of Death was handing me something.
I was just saying, even with all the research that you put into a lot of your books, are there any times that you want to say, well, I have a theory about this that I want to incorporate it, or I want to take a creative liberty with this and put my own spin on it that you write into?
Well, to a degree you have to, because even though I was able to get the medicine, the science to give me a fairly strong scientific structure for the zombie things, there's a point at which we have to step into, okay, well, prion disease will not actually do this. And that's why I hooked it to the unnamed parasites that create the aggressive behavior and so on. Luckily, science can't do this at the moment. So there are some creative liberties. But even with the creative liberties, I like staying within the bounds of possible. When I ran these ideas, I mean, a lot of the stuff came from the research I was doing with people for Zombie CSU. We're talking world-class epidemiologists and scientists in various fields. And when I ran the scenarios by them, a lot of times they were saying, well, it isn't so much whether it's impossible, it's more like when will it be possible, which is creepy. And in fact, a lot of what was on a lot of the genetics in Dragon Factory, these guys were giving me time spans. You know, that'll be possible in 5 years, that'll be possible in 10 years. I take license to allow it to happen closer to our current time,
but most of the stuff is possible or will be possible at some point in the foreseeable path of scientific development. And that's why I find the books frightening to write, because, you know, a writer writes the sort of book they want to read. This is the kind of book that, you know, I wanted to read, and I'm scaring myself with it. Because, actually, there's one little side note here. There was a different book planned for book three. I had come up with an idea for a really good terrorist attack on the United States, and it's really, really good, and so good it will work. So I was advised not to do it. I do plan at some point to write a book called Unstoppable about a writer who creates an unstoppable plot and then is being chased by the terrorists who actually want to know what that plot is. That will probably be a Joe Ledger spinoff if things go well. But that's one of the weird parts about being a writer is you can actually come up with some really, really bad stuff.
I guess on the second part of that, are there any times in which, I suppose, maybe a fan or somebody you knew suggested something that really scared you and wanted to incorporate that?
Not yet. But I'm open to it.
So the great way you get around the concept of, oh, that's so good you shouldn't write it, is to write a book about writing the book about it.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
Because you never actually have to explain what it is.
Right. It's the suitcase in Pulp Fiction, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Right there, yes.
I was just wondering, going actually backwards, do you have any plans to do anything about the Ghost Road Blues trilogy?
Yeah, yes, I do. For those who haven't read the Ghost Road Blues trilogy, it's a series of three novels set in rural Pennsylvania, Ghost Road Blues, Dead Man's Song, and Bad Moon Rising. I have a sequel planned, but not yet pitched. And I have two prequels planned, but not yet pitched. I need to come up for air at the moment to be able to pitch them, but the sequel will follow Mike Sweeney as an older teenager in high school. Working title, Black Marsh High. The prequels, one called Hellhounds on My Trail, is the story of the Bone Man from childhood in Mississippi through the blues community, the blues, a lot of the superstitions and legends dealing with the blues up until he gets to Pine Deep. And I also have one that I probably will pitch first, about a character named Big Mick Sweeney, who's Mike Sweeney's grandfather, comes back, just gets out of the Airborne Rangers at the end of World War II, and goes home to Pine Deep and finds out that the war has intruded into Pine Deep. And that one, I have a first draft on. I just need to get the time to pitch it. But I do plan to return to that series. I doubt it'll be with Pinnacle Books, the publishers who currently have it. Most likely we'll pitch that to St. Martin's or some similar company.
So before we, since we veered away from Patient Zero for a second, I think we should take a moment to, I know you have your comics up here, if you'd like to say something about what you're doing there in that arena.
Yeah, I'm kind of doing a bunch of different things. I started writing for Marvel Comics recently. I'm the regular writer for Black Panther comic, which up until recently was a male character, and Marvel got a lot of heat for having that male character injured by Dr. Doom and his sister taking the role of the Black Panther. And I took the comic over with issue 7, and I've turned it into a political comic, and there's a lot of action in it, and we're working on making the character an A-list character, and the character never was before an A-list character. Dr. Doom and Namor, Submariner, are big characters in it. Fantastic Four with regulars in it, and we have a bunch of new villains as well. And I'll be doing things that will upset a lot of fans until they read the end of the arc, and then they'll get really pissed off at me, and then I'll have to read the next arc, which hopefully will make them like me again. But it's all about taking risks. I'm also one of the four writers involved in Marvel Zombies Return. First issue just came out. Fred Van Lent wrote. David Wellington, who wrote Monster Island, Monster Planet, is doing second issue. I'm doing the third issue, which is Wolverine and Spider-Man, which will be out the 17th of this month. Fourth will be by Seth Graham Smith, who did Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And then Fred Van Lent will come and do issue 5. And one's coming out each week, and they'll be collecting it as a hardcover or a trade paperback. They're doing both versions in January. I also did a Punisher Naked Kill for the Marvel Max line, very adult stuff. Wolverine, I'm now actually, my editor asked me to pitch a Deadpool Black Panther crossover, which will be a comedy comic. If you ever read the Deadpool character, he's insane. He has two inner voices that he talks with. One of whom is like a drinking buddy, and he's fallen in love with the new Black Panther and getting into trouble, calling it Panther Envy. And I'm also doing Punisher Last Gun on Earth, which is a my take on it, the apocalypse with the Punisher. A plague sweeps the world, for the Marvel Knights line. It's a plague sweeps the world that turns everybody into cannibals. Human cannibals, but cannibals. And he's the only one immune, and he feels responsible for the plague, for reasons you'll need to find out in the book. And has set up his own tribal lands in Central Park. And the big bad is Spider-Man and his tribe. I get to kill almost everybody in Marvel. It's fantastic. And the closing scene of the first issue is Central Park with stakes all the way around it with the heads of all these supervillains and heroes that he's killed. It's going to be great.
Bringing shades of Richard Matheson to the Marvel Universe.
Richard Matheson, I Am Legend, my favorite all-time book. Gave me a copy when I was a teenager and told me a lot about writing. But yeah, I've never seen... I would love to actually write a script that would be faithful to I Am Legend. That would be nice.
That would be nice.
But since I can't, or I'm not able to at the moment, instead what I'm doing is Punisher Last Gun on Earth. And they're already talking sequels with Wolverine, with Deadpool, and a few other characters.
Nice one. Yes, right there.
In Patient Zero, I was sure, because I read Zombie CSU, that you're going to pick Prion Disease to be your zombie delivery system. What made you decide to use Parasite to deliver it over anything else, and did you have any other ideas for that?
Well, the prion disease was there because it, you know, fatal familial insomnia, but it's too slow a disease. I need something that would amp it up. And when I talked to a couple of guys who were experts in prion disease, as much as somebody can be an expert in prion disease, they said that if it ever gets attached to something, and they said, like a parasite, that's very aggressive, and there are some parasites in the insect world. There's one that attacks ants that makes the ant goes in and attack everyone, you know, every other ant in the nest. He said there are things in the insect world that if somebody could marry that to the prion disease, it would speed up the rate of infection and the rate of aggression. And he said, but nobody would be crazy enough to do that. And I'm thinking, I can think of at least one writer to be crazy enough to do that.
You know just the person.
Yeah, so that's what I did. So I had that idea fairly early on, and I stuck with it. It worked. And the scientists who I discussed the plot with, who were all thanked in the acknowledgments page, all said, yeah, that's the one that's going to keep us up at night.
So basically you're giving a bunch of scientists insomnia.
Yeah, which is my favorite thing, you know, creep them out.
Yes.
Having read Patient Zero, I'm sure you've given thought to this, as I'm sure many of us have. In the likely event of a zombie outbreak, what would be your preferred primary, secondary, and melee weapon?
I'm really, really good with a katana. I've been practicing kenjutsu since 1968.
Respect.
I will get me through a mess of zombies. You don't need to reload, and they're real quiet. I will real quickly, anyone who is following me or with me, I will teach them the very basics of how to block and smash. Block the arm, hit the head or neck. You know, we can do that with a club, stick, anything.
What was that weapon?
Katana, Japanese sword.
Oh.
I will survive the zombie apocalypse. Now, fast zombies of the new Dawn of the Dead version or the 28 Days Later version, it's an unwinnable scenario for anyone. You can survive the moment, you will not survive the year. And why would you want to? But the Romero zombies, yeah, I definitely will survive that. In fact, I had a conversation with Tony Todd about that. He was in the remake of Night of the Living Dead. And I asked him, I said, you know, I know Ben dies in that, but would Tony Todd get out? I said, oh, yeah, Tony Todd get out. Yeah. My secondary weapon would be probably either a Bowie knife or a Marine K-bar. Great for close quarters work. The other thing would be carpet. I would wrap myself in carpet. Mm-hmm. In fact, in my young adult novel, Rotten Room is coming out, there's a lot of things there that are very practical. You ever try to bite through a piece of carpet? You're not going to do it. They're in a house. They got carpets. Cut it up. Wrap it around your body. You know, wrap it around your head. I don't care if they can bite you. They're not going to bite through the carpet. You can stroll through the zombies. You know, you bash and stroll if you want to. Yes, you'll sweat a lot. So what? It's just so practical. So in that story, which takes place 14 years after the apocalypse, one of the professions is selling carpet coats. Another thing that I'm having fun with is it's called something called erosion art. The last communities are small gated communities, small fencing communities in California in this story. And the zombies, you know, are still, you know, kind of loitering around the towns where they're created, because why would a zombie go anywhere? Once it's a zombie, there's no prey to chase, it'll stay. So they hire bounty hunters to go and find family members who are zombies and kill them. It's called quieting them. And what they do is they give a photo to an artist who then does a portrait of that person as a zombie. It's called the erosion portrait.
There's somebody here doing that.
Yeah, I know. There's several people doing it. In fact, he's one of the guys that I've been talking to. There's another one, Rob Sacchetto, who does zombie portraits. And Mac Caldwell, a few others. Kids also collect zombie cards in the book. So, you know, depending on how successful this is, we're actually, you know, hoping that either Simon & Schuster, or if it's picked up by a movie company, that they'll authorize a set of zombie cards. And guys like, I think it's Flegel, I think his name is, the one who's here, and a few of the others will be able to do the zombie cards, be fun.
Well, I know we're about to close out here, so before we ask for last words from yourself, I know you talked about feeding the need of fans. So if, while people are waiting for Dragon Factory to come out, or your next book, what are some other zombie books that that you like, that you would feel like you could recommend?
Jesus, there's so many. The thing is, I like, zombie books are to me like zombie movies. I like even the bad ones. Because if there's zombies in it, you pretty much already have two-thirds of my interest anyway. So I give a lot more credit to a zombie novel than I would to say, a bad vampire novel. But there are luckily a lot of good ones out there. And they're not always the ones, I mean, everybody knows about Brian Keene's books and David Wellington's and Max Brooks. I don't need to pitch you on those. Joe McKinney's book, Dead City, I love that book. It is basically one long action scene. He's getting the hell out of Austin by a cop, and he's just killing people. And by the way, he is a cop in Austin, so it's very accurate stuff. I like Travis Atkins stuff, J.L. Bourne stuff. I've only read one David Moody book. Actually, he's sending me some others. But my favorite thing to give you your zombie fix is Robert Kirkman's Walking Dead comic. It is Night of the Living Dead in flavor, in tone, in respect, in everything. In comic book form, you get 22 pages of it a month, and it's brilliant. I absolutely love that book. I'd say that is the best zombie writing I've ever seen. And I actually think he's done better stuff, and don't throw anything at me, than Romero. Now, granted, Romero created it, did some great stuff, but Kirkman, you know, in the 60-some issues he's been doing that, has just taken it the next step and the next step and the next step. And it's brilliant, insightful, complex, character-driven zombie stuff. I really highly recommend it.
And brutal.
And, totally uncompromising. He doesn't have a shred of sentimentality in his body. That's great. It makes us like the characters. Then he'll kill them, torture them, whatever. And also, just a quick plug, this is not zombie related, but next year I have three novels coming out. I have Dragon Factory, I have Rotten Ruin, I also have The Wolfman coming out in February, which is the novelization of the Benicio del Toro, Anthony Hopkins, Hugo Weaving, Emily Blunt remake. It's coming out in February, right time for Valentine's Day, because nothing says romance like visceral werewolf slaughter. They did a great job reimagining the film. They set it in the 1800s, and it's beautiful and brilliant and much more complex. And Wolfman was my favorite Universal film, and they did a hell of a job with the new one. Rick Baker did the makeup effects, and the book comes out a week before the film, which is a little close, but it'll be out from Tour Books in February.
So. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. And don't forget, Larry Smith has the books, and I'll see you guys around.
Thanks
for coming out. Great.
Yeah, we got surprised. You man there who talked about the ESU and the blind. I think you need the big prize because you kept us going for the longest.
No, break.
Oh, no.
I love me some time.
Too much.
Yes. That is for you.
Awesome, thank you.
There's also flyers up here with information about Dragon Factory and my panelists.
Oh, well, there you go.
I'll do third-person shooters all day long.
Would you like a zombie dismember me doll?
Yeah.
Thanks for asking the question.
A couple seconds before you touch the big screen.
Hi, you call.
I'm glad you liked it.
A deep space mining.
Did you see it? I've seen it.
Yes.
Brandon.
Are
you
serious?
Don't watch it until I... Don't.